The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson, James Forsyth, Kate Andrews and Katie Bors. And the reason we're all here today is to talk about vaccine diplomacy. I wrote about this recently for a cover piece for The Spectator, in which I looked at the Russian and Chinese attempts to use the vaccines to further their soft power gains abroad. But now it looks like America is also getting into the race, and I wonder whether or not the UK and the EU should be doing more as well. Kate, to start with, maybe you can just update us on what the US has been doing on this front.
So we found out in the last day that America is going to jump into the vaccine diplomacy race, as you say, Cindy, and they're going to be giving out 4 million doses to Canada and Mexico. Not a ton in the grand scheme of things, because that will account for about 2 million people needing 2 doses each. But what's interesting is they're going to give away the AstraZeneca vaccine. That has been approved in Canada and Mexico. It has not been approved in the US. So I think they're very much playing on this idea that there's no point in sitting on these vaccines if Americans themselves are not using them, makes it slightly easier, politically speaking, to give them away. But as James has pointed out in his Times column for Friday, Canada has actually purchased more vaccines per resident in the country than I think any other country in the world. And yet they have very few because countries like the US are holding on to them and they won't export them even when Canada's legally and legitimately bought them. So it's hard to say that the US is being particularly benevolent here, because arguably Canada could have more vaccines if they were operating on more of a level playing field. But this does seem to be the first indication, and there are others as well, which we can talk about in a bit, the quad, so to speak, of other developed countries that want to make sure that their stamp is on the vaccines that are going out to poorer areas of the world, because they know that China and Russia are very happy to play this game.
James, as Kate mentioned in your column today, you write that it seems like the UK can't even rely on other market-respecting democracies when you look at the US, but also the EU. Can you talk a little bit about whether or not this Western alliance is going to stick together when it comes to vaccine diplomacy?
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things is the US uses its might and muscle. You know, it has had an executive order in place banning the export of vaccine. That's one of the reasons, and the Defense Production Act, why the US has been able to ramp up its immunization program so successfully. And I think the EU has looked at that in frustration. And I think what you saw with Ursula von der Leyen's threat on Wednesday is an EU attempt to essentially replicate what the US is doing, to basically say vaccine doses that get produced within the bloc won't leave the bloc. Now, I think there are two problems with this. First of all, these vaccines aren't developed by the EU, they're developed by private companies. And secondly, these supply chains are global. You know, for example, the lipids that tend to be used in the manufacture of the Pfizer vaccine in Belgium come from the UK. So it's, you know, as one cabinet minister put it to me, it's kind of hard for anyone to be totally autarkic on vaccines. But I think the EU move is a fascinating move, because if they do go ahead with it, I mean, the interesting question is whether the EU is a big enough market and has enough heft to essentially behave in the way that the US does and say, and, you know, will, for example, if Pfizer were forced to break their contract with the UK by the EU, would they just accept that in the way that US firms accept the US government's ability within the United States to limit their ability to export? I think this is a potentially kind of very interesting development. And I think you see here the EU trying to say, right, we are going to behave in the same way that the US behaves.
Katie, where's the UK in this vaccines race? In my piece recently, I looked at the way in which India is working with the UK to distribute the AstraZeneca jab across the world. But it seems like the UK's shortage this week might be down to India as well. So where does that leave the UK? Is it playing the game?
Well, Boris Johnson was very careful in the press conference on Thursday not to criticise India. So even though that is being linked to why we have a reduced number of doses to be put out, Boris Johnson would not criticise him and say, as several journalists pointed out at the time, he would Brussels when this happens. And I think that suggests a couple of things. One, we know the Prime Minister plans a trip to India. We know that there's hope for a deal there. And I think therefore they're being diplomatic. But two, I think there is just general hope that they could actually work something out and this isn't a completely closed door. I think you're looking more, I suppose, widely on the UK approach. You've written about vaccine diplomacy. I think we'll see more of that from the UK. They obviously, as James wrote in his Times column, helped Australia to a degree getting doses after the EU blocked that. But once we have all adults vaccinated in the UK, all adults offered a vaccine, that is the point where ministers really think they can start almost not throwing their weight around, but showing what an influential and lovely country they can be and how independently, you know, they can scatter doses here and there. And I think if you look at the general amount ordered, which is far more than we need as a country, even if we do factor in booster doses and so forth, I think that's something to come. But just touching on, I suppose, James's point about supply chains, I mean, this is something that UK was aware about fairly early on. I've written about the vaccine task force previously, and Patrick Vallance, from really the very beginning of working out what they were doing in vaccine procurement, was talking about onshore manufacturing. And that's why you had a situation where the Oxford vaccine is, you know, we have fill and finish, which has been done in Wrexham, all these parts of it, you know, connected so you can be self-sufficient. And it's not just going to be in the Oxford vaccine. You also have Novavax, which is going to be produced in Teesside, and also, you know, plans to produce another vaccine in Scotland. So you can see that the UK does want to make this its own industry, and the plans have been there for quite a while. I think all these factors that are coming up encourage that view, but the sense that you couldn't really rely on supply chains was clocked pretty early on, partly because we all thought America could be the proper cause of vaccine nationalism. It's more widespread, but these were the founding principles when you're starting to work out how you're going to do these things anyway.
Fraser, picking up on what Katie mentioned from James' column about the UK sending vaccine doses to Australia, it's not something that we've heard about much in this country, and presumably that's because politicians don't want to be seen as valuing other countries' citizens over our own. But do you think people are having the wrong attitude to this whole vaccines race altogether? Is it altogether too nationalistic, too nativist?
Yes, it is. I think that since the pandemic started, we've seen this drawbridge up mentality and this really rather depressing idea of wanting to, of course, you know, in a pandemic crisis, you want to look after your family first. That's kind of human nature. But let's take yesterday, for example. The Prime Minister told us he got a vaccine. Now, he ought to be last in line for those vaccines. He's had the virus. He'll have natural immunity. It is yet to be established by anybody just how much of an advantage it gives you to have the vaccine if you already had the virus. I'm not saying that it was improper for him to have one, but it seems a very strange list of priorities. I would have certainly have given vaccines to those who haven't had the virus of any age before I'd give those who have, given the almost the tiny number of reinfections. I think I'm right in saying there's not a single documented case of COVID reinfection in Britain.
You know, we hear about it all the time.
We do hear about it, and there have been studies done where they will say that, you know, when they go in to reassess people and they find out that as part of this study somebody did have it. But there is a world database where they count how many people actually, you know, here's the name, here's the example of where they got reinfected, and that database doesn't have a single British person on it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, I'm sure that it does, just that it's very, very rare. And in my view, that's why people who've had the virus ought to be last in line, because a lot of other people need it. Now, I'll tell you why I feel quite strongly about it, that right now, we are still in we are still Europeans here, and there are people in Europe dying, 2,000 a day, dying for the lack of a virus. My father-in-law in Stockholm, he's quite ill right now. He would badly need a vaccine. He isn't getting one. And I find something deeply uncomfortable about us giving vaccines to people who realistically are in no real need of them. It's almost like in the middle of a famine, you're giving one guy like dessert and pudding while there are still people starving in the other corridor. There are people dying right now because of these vaccines we're giving to people who are in no serious risk of fatality. Now, Katie says that our approach is to cover every single adult and then start to be generous. I don't see why that generosity shouldn't start when we've covered all the over 50s, because those under 50 are really in no serious risk of dying, as opposed to the over 80s. Take Portugal, for example. Bruno Massai, a former Portuguese foreign minister, was saying the other day that Portugal's got one of the higher rates of vaccination in Europe, but still half of its over 80s are unvaccinated. They are still very vulnerable. They're in the grip of a third wave. In this country, the virus is almost entirely gone. So right now we're availing ourselves of vaccines that aren't really much use to us, but are of life or death use to our neighbours. And also, and you could argue that Australians don't have much use of it as well. That was the Italian argument when they asked for the EU to block the export of vaccines to Australia, saying, look, they've got their policy, none of them got the virus. Why do they? And I've actually got more sympathy with that argument than I do with the idea that Britain should start to vaccinate the already immune, rather than care about our Irish, French, German, Polish, Romanian, Portuguese neighbours.
Kate, do you think politicians can get beyond that sort of, you know, nationalism?
Well, I think the difficult thing here is that we're not just talking about nationalism, we're talking about the very practical applications of coming out of lockdown. And for better or for worse, and I think that's very debatable, the UK has decided to take one of the most cautious approaches to coming out of lockdown. Despite having some of the lowest levels of COVID in Europe, we have one of the strictest lockdowns in the developed world. And I think the problem is that it's politically difficult, having, you know, told the nation for months now that it's very dangerous to meet outside, for example, even though the evidence from the very beginning of this virus is that it's very difficult for the virus to transmit outside, treating every single social and economic situation as dangerously equal means that you can't then turn around and ship all of your vaccines off to other countries and go ahead and open up. You know, they've taken this line that every adult has to be vaccinated for us to open. It would be very difficult to change that line or to keep people in lockdown while we're shipping out these vaccines. I mean, I very much agree with Fraser in principle. I think that when we're talking about actually protecting the elderly and vulnerable worldwide, this is not the approach to do that. But politically speaking, I think it's difficult to do otherwise. And we're also looking at the politics on the vaccine diplomacy race. The Quad, which I mentioned earlier, America, India, Japan, and Australia, hope to send 1 billion doses to other parts of Asia by the end of 2022. And this comes down to politics. I mean, I'd love to say this is only about the goodwill of these nations to get people vaccinated, but it's not. It's trying to push back on the influence of Russia and China. The political difficulty that the EU is now facing, and perhaps this is unfair, but I think true, is that people expect the US and potentially India to take a nation-first attitude. Biden's almost covered by the fact that we had 4 years before him of an America-first slogan. He says he's against that, but that's what he's doing right now. He's protecting his stash of vaccines. He's cutting off exports. But the EU is different. The EU's entire principle, their entire foundation is that, you know, we act for the greater good. We are this free market, open, inclusive bloc. I mean, in many ways they're not, but that's what they say. And to act in this very nationalistic way will follow them now. Manufacturers will remember it. Businessmen and women will remember it.
I think the bigger point with the EU is that they parade themselves as being rules-based organization, that we follow these rules. They're just breaking up, turning up these rules. They're saying, you know what, when push comes to shove, we are going to just ignore the laws, just like Putin does in Russia. Now, the reason that one would invest in the EU rather than Russia is because you would have protection against that kind of thing. You'd think that property, international law, all of these things would apply. In fact, we're finding out now that when the EU gets in a panic, it's prepared to write whatever laws it wants. That will be remembered once the pandemic is over.
I have to say, the Chinese government is probably not too surprised that this is the way the Western world is playing this at the moment, considering that's what they accuse the West of all the time, of, you know, doing things to their own interests when push comes to shove.
Yeah, it's amazing how much we're copying China, though, and so many of these regards, and how quickly our principles of internationalism and rules-based order melt when we hit panics like this.
James, let's talk about India for a bit, because as Kate mentions, the Quad is relying on India manufacturing, not the SII, which is providing the AstraZeneca jabs, but something called Biological E, which is a different vaccine manufacturer, but both are giants in the country and in the world for vaccine manufacturer. But can the Quad rely on India's multilateral approach when it comes to this, if we're already seeing trouble with the AstraZeneca supply?
Yeah, I think the question is, the Indian government is trying to balance the needs of vaccinating its own population against its diplomacy. I think what's interesting about this diplomacy is it takes the Quad, which is a military alliance, which is fairly clearly anti-China, and is repurposing it into a vaccine alliance, with the US and Japan paying India to manufacture the vaccines and Australia taking charge of the distribution. And I think it is interesting because it, A, shows how vaccines are becoming a tool of diplomacy. And I think it's also interesting because it marks another example of India moving. One of the big questions is the West cannot hope to contain China if India is not prepared to join in this effort. And I think the significance of this is it's A, proof that India is prepared to join in this effort, and secondly, it is proof when before the Biden administration took office, there was a lot of speculation about whether the Biden administration would want to do business with India, because Narendra Modi was very close to Donald Trump. He is a Hindu nationalist, and I don't think he's going to win any awards for kind of Liberal Democrat of the Year.
But still invited to a Democratic D10 alliance.
I said Liberal Democrat. And, but I think what is interesting here is this is a sign of the Biden administration's willingness to work with India as part of his effort to push back on China. I mean, it's one, it might be one of the lot, I think one of the ways in which COVID, I mean, the COVID is going to change the world in two ways. One is it has made China and China's desire for influence and power the kind of central geopolitical issue of the 21st century. And secondly, I think everyone is seeing in the ways that Fraser and Kate and Katie all talked about how borders come back in crisis and domestic manufacturing matters. And I think every advanced country at the end of this is going to look at what their ability to manufacture stuff is. I think the lesson that Canada will take from this crisis is we need some vaccine manufacturing capability of our own, because otherwise we're going to get caught out. And I think everyone is going to start thinking like this. And so I do think that the era of intense globalization that we have been in since 2001, I think is undoubtedly going to slow now. I think we're going to see lots of people looking to bring supply chains back onshore.
Katie, do you think there's much chatter and thinking in Westminster about what the UK should do after it's vaccinated the UK population, let's say in July, which countries to target, and which countries maybe they don't want to target so much, and so on?
Yeah, there's some. I mean, I think obviously we're part of a scheme where poorer countries are something we are funding and is seen as a priority. I think that there are many who think, Fraser's talking about Europe as a whole. I think that one country you particularly hear about there is the Republic of Ireland, and the fact that as our closest neighbour, that should be the priority if we have surplus vaccines. And I do think that there are some who make the case, perhaps for slightly different reasons than Fraser was making the case, but they do make the case they should go to Europe. I think it's slightly tactical and perhaps a bit of the sense that they'd be saying, look, after everything you've said, we're going to be the magnanimous partner, and perhaps sort of reset certain relationships in terms of Brexit and the things you won't move on. I think you can see why that might be a tactical thing to do.
Isn't it depressing, though, that you'd only think of this for a tactical, cynical advantage? Why can't you do it because it's the right thing to do, because we might genuinely care about people in Poland dying? So much has been disorientating about the last year, but it doesn't seem like that long ago that we were all agreeing in all this masses of money given in foreign aid because we, Britain, should care about people on the other end of the world. And now, the way things are going right now, it's almost like, look, there's a bit Adam Smith wrote about how if there was an earthquake in China and people would die, your average person would hear about it, but not really care that much because it was an abstract notion, because it was China, like, other end of the world. Now, but right now, these people are dying over the sea from us, and we still think, oh, that's all right, let's just make sure that the already immune are given a vaccine because we want to be completely sure. It's just the kind of the collapse of internationalism, the collapse of a notion of our moral responsibility to our neighbours, the collapse of a notion of a neighbour is still something that's left me reeling. I still mourn the pre-COVID days, not simply because of the crisis, but in the way that we thought about and cared about each other internationally a lot more than we seem to now. And this is why James's Times column that we've referenced about four times in this podcast, but it is brilliant. It was so right to conclude that we're looking at the end of an era of globalization, not just in trade, but about basic the notion of fraternity, which was being expanded after the Cold War, and it's now shrinking. Who is my neighbor? Well, probably the guy in the next village, but beyond that, I'm not sure that we've got an international sense of fraternity anymore.
I do think it's interesting that ultimately, if we're looking at countries ahead on vaccinations, it seems that Israel, America, the UK have all taken a strategic decision to vaccinate the entire adult population. We also hear about potentially child vaccination before looking ahead. And I think that because that is part of a trend, you can imagine a different scenario if a couple of countries chose to go the other way and said, well, actually, if we look at mortality and dates, and yes, there's variants, but we think the moral case in terms of the fact that rather than vaccinating everyone in the fear of a variant, we think we should go with the data on mortality, I think that would put pressure on countries. But there isn't any pressure in that sense, because There's no country doing that. And therefore, I think that helps to explain a bit why we are in a situation when we're talking about vaccinating 21-year-olds before sending vaccines en masse somewhere else.
James, I know we have to let you go, but before you go, pre-COVID, all you needed was love?
Okay, Cindy, elaborate. That's a song reference a bit too obscure, even for me.
I just thought your message was so touching. But clearly international relations isn't just all about love.
I get it.
I don't know. What's Cindy talking about? Can somebody explain Cindy's, Cindy's debut song reference?
I think she was...
Historic moment on this podcast.
She was summing up your very eloquent points, Fraser, that before international... So before COVID, you were saying that we cared more about the safety of others and the well-being of others than we do now.
Yeah, so all you need is love.
All you need is love.
Well, you sure, look, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah, which is the way I put it, James.
So, Cindy, the way I would say it is, you know, the John Lennon song, Imagine There Are No Countries, it seems as even further away. You know, I don't think it's a particularly ideal notion, but I think the state or the nation state or the bloc has really come back in this crisis. I think you have seen this, and I think that, you know, I think we are entering into a new era where borders will matter more than they did before, not just in terms of trade and vaccines and manufacturing supply chains, but also, you know, people's attitude to international travel is going to change. You know, we've gone through a period where this country, traditionally very liberal country on this kind of stuff, is making people who fly in from certain places spend 10 days in a hotel. You know, look at the success of Australia, forcing everyone arriving in the country to quarantine in a hotel before being allowed out. All of this is going to change attitudes, and it will take quite some time, if we ever do, to go back to the world that we lived in pre-COVID.
Kate, final thought to you?
Found this all very depressing, to be totally honest, so I have more to reflect on than to comment right now. But now I think James and Fraser are completely right that the reality now is that countries are going to be looking inward. And, you know, you can certainly make the case, given what countries like Canada, even now potentially the UK, are facing, having made the right decisions 9-10 months ago about vaccines, having others withholding them, that would lead you to question your own manufacturing capabilities. But I'm with Fraser, I'm deeply concerned that some of the wrong lessons will be taken away from this. I mean, broadly speaking, globalization has made us all far more prosperous, not just in terms of wealth, but in terms of experience. And I do fear quite deeply that attitudes have shifted.
I have to say, you guys are surprisingly starry-eyed, because I think that countries exist to serve their own citizens, right? I mean, that's why we've got national borders. That's why we've got nation states. What government is not going to look after its own citizens?
So,
and we'd want it to be this way, wouldn't we?
No, I agree with you, Cindy. Countries obviously put their own residents and citizens first, but I think the major difference now is that when actually tested, the love for one's neighbour, and certainly the love for somebody living on the other side of the world, it actually proves to be quite thin.
If you look at the British tradition, though, ours has never been that way. If you look at let's take from John Donne saying, like, no man is an island, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Let's take the anti-slavery movement with those coins by Josiah Wedgwood in 1787, am I not a man and a brother? You were a slave making that point to the reader. The point was that the average Brit would regard this slave as a brother, that Britain would be the country which would look abroad and would liberate people in problems. And right now, that's what I keep coming back to. Like, the people who are dying of COVID right now, one hour, 2 hours flight from this country, are they not our brothers, to use Josiah Woodward's language? I would say that they are, and that we owe them, and that we're failing in that responsibility.
Kate, James, Fraser, and Katie, thanks very much.